Nemoto presents filmmaking giants. Steven Spielberg, the master of modern blockbusters. Narrated with Microsoft Azure using the Christopher voice. Running time, approximately 21 minutes. Steven Spielberg. Hello and welcome back to Filmmaking Giants Who Changed How We See the World. Today we walk down a suburban street that keeps turning into an adventure, past sprinklers and mailboxes and the hum of a television left on in a den, and then, without warning, into a highway where a truck decides to hunt you, onto a beach where the water looks ordinary until it doesn't, into a cornfield that suddenly becomes a runway for light, into an attic where a child builds a world out of toys that turn out to be instructions for mercy. Our guide is Steven Spielberg, the director who made spectacle personal and intimacy spectacular, who built the modern blockbuster and then refused to be trapped by it, who took the grammar of wonder and taught it to argue, who erased the border between popular and serious by trusting that both start with attention. He did not invent awe, terror, or tenderness. He taught cameras to carry them with clean hands. He was a boy who pointed a camera at his sisters and begged them to fall dramatically. He was a teenager who built a train crash out of model railroads because he wanted to see physics confess. He was an anxious kid in Phoenix and then in Northern California and then in the small towns whose air always smells faintly of lawn. He was a child of mid-century America's twin catechisms. Synagogue on a calendar that taught him the dignity of ritual, television as a liquid companion that taught him how quickly a story can own a room. He shot on 8mm and then on 16mm. He learned to cut by hand, to tape, to borrow, to ask. He learned that every family has the scene you aren't supposed to film and that those are the scenes that end up explaining everything. There's a photograph of him on a cul-de-sac with a camera that seems too large for his shoulders, and the face is the face you keep seeing in his films. Hungry, a little shy, easily delighted, stubborn about truth. The first professional calling card duel is a nightmare told in daylight. A salesman in a small car meets a tanker truck on a two-lane road. The truck decides, for reasons it doesn't owe us, to erase him. The film is a manual on how to arrange dread with clean tools. Lens choice to make a grill into a skull, sound to make a downshift into intention, geography turned into a chessboard whose squares you measure by mile markers, editing that accelerates and then doesn't, so that patience becomes the most frightening thing on screen. Duel taught him, and a generation, that you can build enormity out of the ordinary if you respect sight lines and tempo. The villain has no face. The villain is mass. The hero is a habit. Look far enough ahead to keep a margin, act soon enough to keep the wheel. You watch it now and feel the outline of a career, craft that refuses to show off, motion tied to thought, protagonists learning that the world is bigger than their loneliness. Then Jaws. The shark did not work. Mechanical contraptions seldom enjoy salt water. The ocean pulled pranks and the budget sulked. The director was too young to be as frightened as he should have been. So he changed his plan. He let the water tell the story. He let a fin be a sentence. He asked John Williams not for background but for a noun. Two notes that say, inevitable, and then growl until inevitability becomes a tide. He pushed into Roy Scheider's face until the lens captured what every parent knows when a backyard ceases to be safe. The speed at which a mind calculates routes, the humiliation of authority that cannot fence the sea. He learned to cut on the break of a wave. He learned to make a horizon act. The film became not just a hit but a calendar. Summer would now belong to a movie. Studios studied the release pattern and called it strategy. Audiences remembered the taste of fear and called it a tradition. The ocean never went back to being innocent, which is another way of saying the camera had told the truth and the truth had stuck. He turned upward and inward with close encounters of the third kind. The film is a conversion story disguised as science fiction. A utility worker sees something inexplicable, loses confidence in the reality his job pays him to maintain, and begins to sculpt a mountain in mashed potatoes because the body believes long before the mouth has found the right sentence. Domestic life begins to wobble under the strain of loyalty versus wonder. The government becomes a chorus of men who love secrets more than truth. Children become barometers, afraid when they are lied to and brave when the light arrives. Spielberg frames faces like landscapes. He asks the camera to listen. He learns to treat beams of light as characters. He lets a melody, five tones, be language. He brings a mothership out of cloud like a city deciding to confess. A very dangerous substance in sloppy hands in his hands becomes a discipline. He uses it not to abolish questions but to keep them open without panic. He shows Bob Balaban translating between arrogance and curiosity, François Truffaut reminding Americans that gentleness is also a credential. He stages the communion on a runway and refuses to turn it into conquest. The child who loved blinking televisions puts worship and reason into one frame and asks them to stop quarreling. 2 years later, he makes Raiders of the Lost Ark and tells the camera to learn how the old guys did it. The film moves like Errol Flynn's sword and Buster Keaton's feet and John Ford's horizon all wrote a letter together. George Lucas brought the serial mythology, Spielberg brought the breath. Set pieces arrive like rhymes, the boulder that remembers the audience is a body, the truck chase that reveals that choreography is a morality, the map room that makes sunlight behave, the well of souls where snakes learn to be punctuation. He did not discover pre-visualization. He practiced it like a craftsman who respects boards before walls. The camera does not show off, it obeys physics. When it breaks the rule, you feel the decision like a punctuation mark. And because adventure is a mode, not an excuse, he lets fear be childlike and courage be adult. He knows that an audience will accept the miraculous if you give them logistical honesty first. You can surf on style as long as you land on sets. He has always knelt to the height of a child. E.T. the extraterrestrial lives at that elevation. He shoots from a low lens so that the world looks unfairly tall, which is how it feels when you haven't learned to drive yet and adults can ruin an evening by deciding. Keys on belts become threats. Pizza is a sacrament. A closet full of stuffed animals becomes a politics. He takes a puppet and a lamp and a vocabulary of hands and carries them to a scene where friendship is not a fantasy but a test. Can you carry another's need without applause? John Williams writes a theme that knows the difference between sentiment and tenderness and behaves like the second even when the first is cheaper. The flying bicycle is a poster. The moment before it, the run, the lift, the surprise, is the craft. He makes grief legible without exploiting it. He makes joy cost something and therefore scale. If this were merely the story of a man who rediscovered the right of wonder for a jaded industry, we could end here with a parade and a box office ledger. But Spielberg did a harder thing. He refused to let the mass audience excuse him from adulthood. The Color Purple looks at a century's mixture of cruelty and survival and decides that resurrection is not an argument you win but a life you keep showing up for. The film was loved widely and argued about loudly. He let that happen. He knows that early in a craft you borrow authority from velocity and later you must borrow it from subjects that can say no to you. Empire of the Sun gave him a boy who had to grow up faster than anyone has a right to. The camera learned to find beauty without colluding with horror. Spielberg discovered, on the other side of his own success, that tenderness has a more difficult job when history is standing nearby. Then he did the double feat that explains why his name belongs in the engineering of the medium, not simply in its theater. In 1993, he released Jurassic Park and Schindler's List months apart. One taught machines a new duty, to imagine creatures so persuasively that the audience did not complain to the math. The other taught a century's pain a new form of evidence, a film that behaves like a witness. Jurassic Park is not a movie about dinosaurs. It is a movie about hubris with dinosaurs as its syllables. He asked Industrial Light and Magic to impersonate evolution and told Stan Winston's team to remind computers that rubber and hydraulics have souls. He used animatronics whenever a hand needed to lay on a flank and pixels whenever a herd had to breathe. He filmed a glass of water so that a ripple became a metronome for dread because he had learned from a truck on a highway that scale is sometimes an argument best made by a cup. He edited the film like a map of responsibility. The engineer who cuts power, the veterinarian who keeps showing up for a triceratops with a cough, the children who discover that bravery is a quiet, repetitive task. He did not make a theme park. He made a cautionary tale that sold 100 million tickets to people who thought they were visiting a theme park and emerged more suspicious of hubris than when they went in. The technology changed the industry, the ethics changed a few minds. The marriage is the point. Schindler's List is shot in black and white because color would have lied. The red coat appears for a moment to accuse, not to decorate. He chose handheld and restraint. He decided not to improve the world by improving the people who injured it and decided instead to record, patiently, unflinchingly, the bureaucracy of extermination and the bureaucracy of rescue. He cut away from heroics sooner than a lesser film would have, because he understood that the movie's job was to put the viewer back into a body, not onto a podium. He found in Liam Neeson a face that could learn. He found in Ben Kingsley a conscience that could shoulder. He found in Ralph Fiennes a void that looks like a man. And he found, after the film, a task. The Shoah Foundation recordings of survivors' testimonies, a library of voices that has nothing to do with box office and everything to do with memory. The director who built illusions with integrity turned his camera into a notary public and asked it to serve history before it served him. When he returned to war with Saving Private Ryan, he dared the medium to be honest about noise. He undercranked his camera and shortened the shutter to make motion tear. He let bullets hiss realistically. He bleached the image to the threshold of memory. The Omaha Beach landing made people leave theaters because their bodies remembered something their minds had not been told. And in the rest of the film, beyond the famous carnage, he practiced something subtler, the ethics of orders. A sergeant obeys and questions in one breath. A captain invents a story about what he did back home because he knows that the men need a picture of a life worth returning to. A translator learns that language offers no shelter when the world is on fire. The ending restores ritual to its proper use. Not to flatter the living but to keep the dead from being used by ideology. Between and after these monuments are rooms you've lived in more than once. The smooth Washington newsrooms of the Post, where small decisions about adjectives become large decisions about courage. The courtrooms and kitchens of Amistad, where words negotiate with trauma and sometimes win. The raindark basements of Minority Report, where fingers on glass demonstrate a choreography for a century of interfaces and the ethics of prediction argue with the economics of detention. The vaulted chambers of Lincoln, where the work of law is not nobility but arithmetic. Speeches matter, but the count matters more. The tidy Brooklyn houses and Soviet stairwells of Bridge of Spies, where decency refuses to be provincial. The terrified cul-de-sacs of War of the Worlds, where a father's incompetence meets obligation in a time that still smelled like September dust. The casinos and grifts of Catch Me If You Can, where lies behave like music until they forget their key. The shadows of Munich, where vengeance rehearses justice until both lose memory, and a director who once found comfort in the clarity of good and evil discovers the ache of ambiguity. The singing corners of West Side Story, where he remakes not the choreography but the camera's right to participate in it. The camera becomes a dancer honest enough to breathe. And The Fablemans, where he finally films the room he avoided filming as a child. A house where excellence and breaking cohabited, a mother who held sunlight and weather in the same hand, a father who thought love is a technology that can be repaired, a boy who learned that forgiveness and craft are not enemies. How does he do it when he's doing it best? He moves the camera only when the thought moves. His famous push-ins are not addiction, they are agreements. The shot promises the viewer that someone in the frame is about to decide something. His tracking shots are odes about logistics, not parades. He blocks conversation so that feelings have geometry, people cross and stop. A doorway becomes a verb. Distance tells the truth that dialogue is avoiding. He lights with curiosity. Windows bloom into rooms so that information feels like daylight, not like lecture. Flashlights cut fog like pencil sketching obligation. Backlight turns a silhouette into the outline of choice. And then he gives the film to three collaborators who have become extensions of his nerve endings. An editor, Michael Kahn, who can breathe tempo like a drummer and still save space for silence. A cinematographer, Janusz Kaminski, who knows how to make air visible and grief legible. And a composer, John Williams, who writes melodies that work like moral compasses, never scolding, sometimes playful. Always prepared to take over when words would either patronize or abandon you. There is also a company of producers, Kathleen Kennedy and Frank Marshall among them, who learned with him that large films can be family businesses in the best sense, where authority is a duty and budgets are promises. There is a studio he helped found, DreamWorks, whose name was briefly a prophecy and then a school. He changed the industry's calendar. Summer is a season you plan around, the winter as well when a hard subject can command a crowd. He changed its hardware, animatronics bent to friendship with digital and proved that the future of effects lay in what you do not show. He changed its regulations. Parents saw that violence and fear had evolved, and a PG-13 rating was born from Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom and from Gremlins that he had shepherded. He changed its conscience. Schindler's List traveled with educators and invited teenagers to look at a century's arrogance with their guard down. He changed its memory, thousands of testimonies rescued from vanishing tape. He even changed how rooms full of engineers imagined work. Minority Report's gesture interface became an R&D project for people who would later build our daily screens. The movie did not merely borrow ideas from the future. It volunteered to help design it. He also kept faith with play. He makes jokes with framing that other directors save for dialogue. He knows how to put a fedora on a hat rack so that it becomes an argument about the next 10 minutes. He knows how to make a shadow refuse to be polite. He knows, better than almost anyone, how to balance the metronome of a scene so that delight can arrive without permission and leave before it becomes familiarity. What do you, not a director perhaps, carry out of his workshop? First, the ethic of wonder. Wonder is not naivete. It is a choice you make to remain present to what is larger than your calculation. In an office that complains of fatigue, put a glass of water on a table and show your team the ripple caused by an invisible knock from somewhere else in the building. Name the knock. That's the Jaws lesson. When you can't show the cause honestly, show the effect precisely and let people's behavior improve. Second, the discipline of the child's vantage. When you design a service or a policy, lower the camera. Kneel. Measure the experience at the height of the person with the least leverage in the room. Keys at belt height are terrifying. Documentation written in legalese reads like a locked door. The ET lens will tell you which of your procedures is an adult protecting themselves rather than a grown-up protecting a child. Third, the marriage of show and withhold. If your organization is tempted to demonstrate competence by dumping information, cut. Hold back the shark until the beach has earned the scream. In writing, in design, in law, in medicine, show less, better, is a Spielbergian policy. When you do show, spend your budget on the one image that will carry credibility on its back for the next hour. Fourth, rehearsed improvisation. The Raiders truck chase was storyboarded within an inch of its life and then shot with agility when the desert demanded it. Build plans that flex without breaking. Plan the doorways and then let weather and people fill the rooms. The magic trick is not spontaneity, it's spontaneity that doesn't injure the schedule. Fifth, collaboration as a renewable energy. The editor, the cinematographer, the composer, the designer, the effects team, the actors, the producers, he keeps returning to the same hands because trust compresses time. If you lead, build a crew whose glances you can read across a room. Loyalty is not sentiment, it is efficiency. Sixth, the refusal to let success freeze you at one register. Spielberg could have made amusement parks forever. Instead, he went to a black and white Poland and let the camera shake. If your platform favors a style that sells, spend at least a season on the subject that doesn't. You'll learn what your style was for. Seventh, respect for the audience. He never lies about what a scene is doing, even when it tricks you. He understands that people will carry responsibility if you hand it to them cleanly. In meetings, in classrooms, in clinics, practice that respect. Tell the truth about what you know and what you don't, then offer people the kind of image, a graph, a case, a detail they can use to act decently. There is a story he tells now with the softness of someone who has survived his own gifts. After years of making the world bigger for other people's families, he turned and filmed his own. The Fablemans is not a confession, it is a peace offering. He shows the beauty that taught him how to see and the breach that taught him why pictures sometimes arrive before apologies. He offers thanks to a mother who believed that art is not an indulgence but a lifeline, and to a father who believed that rigor is not a prison but a gift. And he admits that a camera can wound when it should have comforted. The man who taught the world to look up admits that he sometimes looked away. The admission is a craft note. Greatness doesn't exempt you from amends, it equips you to make them cleanly. He has detractors, of course. They call earnestness a flaw. They mistrust that a melody can earn its climax. They hear a John Williams chord and accuse the film of bribery. They are not wrong to be cautious. Spielberg himself has learned to be. The best of his serious work is vigilant about sugar. He knows now that awe must be earned by accuracy and that sentiment is the cheapest arson. Watch the restraint in Schindler's List, the fatigue in Munich, the legislative boredom in Lincoln that becomes a moral engine precisely because it risks tedium. He is not perfect. No giant is. He is durable because he keeps letting the room teach him. The ledger of his influence is not only box office and Oscars and Academy lectures. It's the way your neighbor, who never cared about cinema, talks about story after a Spielberg film and then tells you something they remembered about their father. It's the way an engineer in a lab decides to build an interface that makes sense without a manual. It's the way a teacher plays the five notes from Close Encounters before a class debate to remind everyone that language has to begin with agreement. It's the way a summer still feels like a door that opens with a studio logo because 48 years ago a fake shark taught the American calendar to breathe in sync with a film. He changed how we see the world by refusing to choose between the big room and the small room, between the spectacle that buys a ticket and the quiet that earns a life. He taught light to behave like generosity and shadow to behave like humility. He trained cranes and dollies and computers to remember that the point of an effect is not astonishment but accuracy. Not can we, but should we? He learned how to scare without lying, how to console without cheating, how to argue with history without treating it as a set. No one who has watched a glass of water ripple on a dashboard will ever again think that small things cannot warn, or that warning is unglamorous. No one who has watched an old man fall to his knees in a cemetery and cry because he thinks he did not do enough will ever again find it easy to measure a life with clean numbers. No one who has watched a child put their hand on the heart of something foreign and feel it beat back will ever again believe that love is merely a grown-up word. Thank you for listening to this episode of Filmmaking Giants Who Changed How We See the World.